today by Josh Miller and Chris Antunes, co-founders of 3Play Media, to break down what they're seeing in the market. We're going to be talking about which dubbing use cases are gaining real traction, how to navigate the AI voice landscape, what's working in production, and where human involvement still matters. Josh, Chris, welcome to NIMSY Live. I really appreciate you being here today.
Thanks for having us. And per your intro, we definitely like to have fun. Hopefully we'll add some value.
Good. Yeah, you and the viewers will have to be the judge of that at the end, but I think that's that sounds good to us.
Very good. Well, like I said, I was keeping the intro brief today. I know who you guys are, and I was just on a call actually with your team earlier this week. But for the sake of the audience, let's give a quick intro here. But first I need to plug, if you guys are ever wondering what's going on with the language technology landscape out there, then I can send you over to the Language Technology Radar. This is the NIMSY Language Technology Radar. We publish a report every year, but we also keep an up-to-date, real-time database because the language technology landscape is changing so fast, you can't just wait for once a year to get all of your information. So we have an annual report. We have the real-time language technology database. We have, I believe, over 1,000 different technologies catalogs in here. And just to prove it to you today, here is 3Play Media's page on the Language Technology Radar. But I'm not going to steal the thunder here. I'm going to turn it over to you guys because you're the founders. And like NIMSY can tell us about you guys, or you guys can tell us about you guys. So
I appreciate that you proved that we're real.
So yes, you're real. If you're on the NIMSY database, you're real. We ask for social security numbers and mother's maiden names in order to get on that list.
So. Perfect.
So you asked who 3Play is. We'll give you the medium version. So okay. not the one sentence and not the, you know, the two hour version. But I think it's good to set context because we are relatively new on the grand scale to the localization space, but we've been focused on video at significant scale and accessibility for a while now. So Josh and I, you mentioned, are two of the co-founders. We started the business 15 years ago, with a little more than that, with two other co-founders while we were at MIT. And we had a problem before we had a business, which there was a group at MIT called OpenCourseWare that was putting content, putting lectures online for free, and they needed to be accessible. Mm. They needed to be captioned. And they had a budget problem and a scale problem. They had thousands of videos and they couldn't pay market rates for it or pay the same rates that you could for, let's say, high-end theatrical or media content. They were ahead of the regulation. Of the requirements legally.
You're right. Regulations always like to come in and mess up our nice capitalistic free markets, don't they?
You know, but, and the regulation got there, but their funding required for this project that those videos be closed captioned or accessible. And so sort of classic entrepreneurial moment, we knew the group and they came to us and said, help, there's got to be a better way. And so exuberance of youth, Josh and myself and our two co-founders thought we'll solve this problem with the robots with AI called speech recognition at the time by the end of the afternoon. And it turned out we couldn't, but it was a great start. So literally from day one for our first customer, we were AI first with tools and human intervention, using those tools to get to the accuracy level, but still at the cost and at the scale that MIT needed.
Yeah.
And so literally within the first week, we were AI tools and people. And that's a through line for the business today still. And I think it's important to set context there because nothing we're doing as we think about how we address this kind of novel AI dubbing or AI enabled dubbing problem is retrofit. We have this long production tested thousands of videos a day, millions of videos over the course of the last 15 years, battle tested, scaled system. AI tools, people, and we're applying it to a different use case, in this case, AI dubbing, which is complex. And I love it for that reason.
Right.
And excited to talk about it. But it's based in the same infrastructure and the same production tested environment with this kind of distributed marketplace of experts we have all over the world piloting it.
But I think this is a good, I love this story because it's a good case to talk about in the will machines take our jobs debate, right? Because, I mean, sure, some of them, right? They're definitely going to change most of them, right? But the reality is the majority of what AI solutions are going to be doing is the type of work that previously just didn't make sense to do. It didn't make sense to do millions of hours or whatever of lectures. But now that there's a technological solution, yes, this becomes feasible. This becomes an actual legitimate conversation.
Yep. Yeah, I think to that point, I mean, the job is different, right? So it's not that there is no job, it's a different job. And right. And not all content's equal as well. So there sure. might be content that the robots do take over, but there's certain content that the robots will maybe never take over. And it's just, it just comes down to a different type of task. And it's about how do we make, I would say even at the time when we started, the idea of captioning thousands of hours a day was unheard of. Hmm. There was no way that could be tackled because of the process, because of the type of job. And so it's just a matter of rethinking it. And like Chris said, the goal is to apply the same methodology to a localization use case.
Hmm. Yeah. And Tucker, you know, I think of myself as a recovering economist and a recovering engineer to some degree.
Yeah.
But I'd say like what Josh said is so true, which is AI is in the news and it's in the zeitgeist today in all these ways. But fundamentally, the problem starts with what are we trying to accomplish and what budget do we have to accomplish it?
Yeah.
That's where we start.
Yeah. Real world constraints. Right. But this kind of gets to, and I'm sorry, I'm already over the place. I came to this meeting with an agenda, but we're out there now. I'll try to rein us back later. But this kind of gets me to a debate and a question that I've been asking people. I think this is the question of our industry for the next 3 to 5 years, probably, which is language a technology solution? Or is language a technology problem to solve? Or is language a people problem to solve? Or is it a hybrid of both? Right now, the safe answer to that is it's a hybrid of both, right?
Agreed. I do think that's the safe answer. And I think it comes back to what's the task, right? What are we trying to accomplish? And I think language is in some ways nicely broad, right? Because that could be, well, I want my ATM screen to be able to be translated into 15 languages so that anybody can use it. That's a very different task from having unconstrained speech in a university lecture or a feature film, and understanding how to go from one to the other, you know, from one language to another. And again, it's also how many people are going to see it. I mean, that matters a lot. It makes a huge difference. Yeah. So the hard part here that people maybe are starting to appreciate, but I think is so critical, is that the machines can't get better and the machines couldn't have gotten to where they are if it weren't for human generated data.
Right.
And so that is a really important part to this too, is that the humans have to be used to actually make it a robot.
Otherwise progress stops.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like Josh said, it's configurability and optionality, like not just, and I know we'll get into use cases and which are kind of ready for production or like, you know, at what stage of the life cycle are they? Are they experimenting? Are they in production? But the reality is not just use case to use case, but even piece of content to piece of content, the requirements are different. Maybe the regulatory environment is different. Maybe the brand safety risk is different for, a sort of high-end theatrical piece of content versus something in a back catalog somewhere of a e-learning platform. And the treatment should vary, but the process shouldn't, right? So you should still be able to order in the same way.
You should
still be able to get the output you need. It should obviously be at a very different price. And really building, and I think that's what some of these new tools and in the AI that's around them allow you to do, is customize your budget, customize the output you want, you know, literally piece of content to piece of content.
Yeah. Well, and you guys are certainly at the forefront of this. You're out there, you're talking to these people, you're talking to the customers. So let me think, it's been a while since I've talked to someone about this specific challenge. I mean, I talked to a lot of people because consultant, right? But so you guys are up to date on what are the most recent challenges. You guys are up to date on what are the most recent technologies out there. Which ones are gaining traction? So when we're talking about a dubbing voice, which ones are gaining tractions and which ones are still like in the experimental phase, right? Because what I've seen over the last couple of years is we're still talking about AI 2 years later, right?
Yeah.
But those conversations have moved out of PowerPoint and into production, right? So it's less like wishful thinking and sales pitches and more like, here, let me give you a demo, right? So in your guys' experience, what are the solutions that are still kind of in the wishful thinking experimental mode? Let's not call it wishful thinking. I don't want to be pessimistic. Let's call it the innovation, the R&D mode, and which ones are actually moving into production.
Yeah, Tucker, it's so interesting, right? I like the framing. There's so many ways you can slice this, right? There's so many different ways you can get at that question. So you even mentioned, I like how you said demo, like PowerPoint, there was a phase, but then even production, you know, you said that word demo and just like pausing there for a second. There's such a difference between a demo, a 5-minute demo in two languages compared to consistent quality at scale. And I think everyone knows that, but it's a hard thing to evaluate. It's a hard thing to evaluate with a vendor and even with a new technology, especially with a new technology. So I think to the extent that there's hesitation and risk mitigation, some of it comes from not even just seeing is the thing that was demoed good enough. How do we get comfortable that this will be good for the 1,000th video in the backlog that we're not going to spend quite as much time reviewing? So we can sort of come back to how we think about that problem. But I think there is a lot more in the demo phase across almost every use case you can imagine. That is for sure. I would say that there are a few big categories, right? There are experienced dubbers and first-time dubbers. So markets, use cases where dubbing has been a part of their globalization strategy, of their sort of global outreach strategy for years and years and years. Very sophisticated buyers, budget already established. That group is quick to test and quick to look at new technologies, but probably less quick to adopt. They have very high standards. They are paying a lot already.
And they have more stakeholders, right? Yeah, and half of those stakeholders, it's literally their job to tell people no, right?
100%.
Once you get wrapped into the InfoSec conversations and the procurement and the lawyers, right? It's like
all of that.
And
at the same time, they also have an appropriate need to be up to date on what's possible.
So right.
And we've heard some other vendors, and you know, I don't think we're uniquely excluded from this, but a number of vendors in our space have talked about kind of like POC hell, right? Where every media company wants to see what's possible. And you know, I think it's up to the organization who is doing the POC to properly qualify what are you trying to accomplish? Are you actually buying or not?
Right.
So I think I think some have not done as good of a job maybe to set their own expectations. But I do think everyone is at least experimenting, I would say.
Everyone's interested.
Yeah.
Right? No one wants to put their foot into the fire yet. Right.
Well, and for that group. So, and I think that group is super sophisticated, always testing. Their bar is high. They shouldn't move the bar. The bar is set in the right place. That's what not only they expect, that's what their users expect. That's what their consumers expect. And that makes sense. That's what the region expects. So they're sampling. Where, to the extent that they're doing more than that, it's on kind of net new content, which is market expanding, which is there's a language or a region that never made economic sense for us at these old prices. There is tier 3 or 4 content in our backlog that never made economic sense at the established prices. Mm-hmm. And to the extent that they're risk seeking or forward leaning, it's in those areas for now for that group. But we love those groups, you know, without naming names, because they're so sophisticated. They're so smart about how they test. And that feedback is gold for anyone developing new technologies and innovating around them like us, even if they're not buyers in the immediate term. Like that feedback is really valuable. From that segment.
And their feedback is valuable. And we're in a very exciting phase right now because we're figuring out what works and where, right? So it's this experimental phase. And we need the feedback from those big buyers. So I think as we figure out the path forward, it's very interesting to look at what are the pain points, needs, challenges, of the big buyers that we know need this solution, but perhaps are hesitant for a number of reasons, right? But we also, I think, need to ask ourselves, what are the needs of the smaller companies? And we don't always ask that because those smaller companies don't have a lot of budget to spend on our products and services that we're selling, right? Yep. But here's a useful thought experiment I encourage people to think about is, if I were starting a global company, whether it's a product, software, services, whatever it is, if I were starting a global company today, how would I set up my localization and dubbing and subtitling functions? Because I'm not constrained by legacy systems. I don't need to make sure it integrates with my Woohoo Woho tool that I developed 18 years ago, and the developer OD'd on heroin 7 years ago, and we don't know. You know what I'm saying? Like, there's so many problems when you're trying to work with Microsoft versus a new company with like 10 people in a garage.
I think that's a great question.
And Tucker, I mean, you must see this all the time. I mean, different types of organizations, either new to localization, experience with localization as a buyer, the bar for what is good enough, and I know you guys talk about this a bunch in your top 100 report, that's shifting, right? It's shifting all over the place. And again, I think organizations, is something, you know, was referenced earlier, that the organizations are realizing that some of their content, the bar is here, and some of their content, the bar is there. And I think that's making it harder in some ways, but also a lot more sophisticated.
Well, in 3Play, this is, you know, again, we started with the backstory, and, you know, we didn't go into a ton of detail on the markets we serve today, but, you know, on the accessibility side, you know, mostly English and Spanish as a starting point, because those for most North American companies are the languages that from an accessibility perspective, they were focused on, but we're across all of the end markets. Anyone who has a video is a potential customer of ours. And in those segments, some of them, there are early adopters for this AI voice-enabled technology. And you also get a ton of great feedback from them. And to your point, without the, Tucker, without all the bureaucracy or the in some cases, you know, red tape of these larger organizations, they can move really quickly. And they have never, in some cases, done this before, for better and worse. But their bar is set in a different way, and they're thinking about a different problem. And they're going to solve it, and they'll experiment quickly and give feedback quickly and iterate with the right partner.
With the right will, right? With the right executive sponsorship and will and pain, I would say. People can move quickly on this.
Well, and in some cases, the YouTube content creator market, we can talk about it later, but it's a good example. I mean, there's like, in some cases, a single decision maker.
Oh, for the YouTube content? Oh, yeah.
So it can move quickly.
Well, it better move quickly because YouTubers have the attention spans of, you know.
I've got three boys, 10 and under. I know a lot about that.
Yeah. So you get it. Right. Very cool. So, you know, I feel like I want to go back. We've had a lot of interesting discussion, but I want to go back. 3Play Media. I'm going to bring up your website here because I can. Who do you work with? What problems do you solve?
Yeah, so for 15 years, we'll say, for the first 15 years of our lives, we were solving an accessibility and compliance issue for the most part. So it could be that a media company has to comply with FCC regulations or the CVAA for web content. It could be that a school has a student accommodation request or needs to adhere to Section 508. There's the Americans with Disabilities Act in the corporate space. So a lot of regulation drives the need for accessible experiences. And I think the cool thing that's happened in the last probably 5-10 years is that far more than just deaf and hard of hearing people or blind and low vision people have realized that these accessible experiences are actually what many of us prefer half the time, if not all the time. So having captions on a video is a pretty common experience for a lot of people now. But that is the vast majority of how we focused our efforts. So captioning, both live and recorded, audio description for blind and low vision. Those are the vast majority of the services we were delivering pretty much up until about a year ago when we started to expand into languages. And it was across three key markets. The education market, which was mostly higher ed. The corporate market, which is a very broad market, and a lot of tech companies doing a lot with video, things like that. Certainly financial services and things like that as well. And then the media company and the media the media industry has been a pretty interesting evolution for us in the way we've addressed it, where we first started with large back catalogs for the big streamers who all kind of got forced into making their content accessible and now is actually a staple of the way they publish content. But that was a big part of how we were able to do it. And it goes back to this approach of how do we make this whole thing scale? We were one of the only providers, if not the only one at the time, you know, we're talking over 10 years ago,
right,
who could deliver a quality captioning file thousands of times over.
Yeah. And we, you know, I mentioned, you know, have processed over 30 million videos this way, 10,000 plus videos a day. And, you know, obviously, workflow has to be automated for us and for our customers. So ingest and delivery, which is not something that we talk about as much, but we have obviously an online portal, but we have, you know, a REST API. We also have integrations with any place there's video, you know, YouTube, Brightcove, you name it. You know, we've got an integration there so that thousands of videos can stream into our system every day without any intervention, without any project management requirement or anything like that. And then often hours later, with full expert review, those caption files or subtitles or audio description files come back to the customer. Same way, API over the, directly back to the video platform. And it's that sort of model that we are really excited to bring into this dubbing space. And I sometimes use this assembly line metaphor, and I feel like it, you know, in some ways it has this sort of negative connotation, but the attributes you need to produce consistent quality at a price that makes sense are what something like this delivers, where you think about all of these components every step with a lot of rigor, and you try to maximize the quality and minimize the cost to our customers and minimize any issues along the way. It's that sort of system thinking that, again, we want to apply to a much more complex problem, because we see, and you know, there's a big macro trend, and it's coming to media, but everywhere. I mean, basic economics, but as the price comes down for this, because of the technology and then on the dubbing side, and the quality continues to rise, the technology gets better, demand will increase. New use cases, new personas, and scale is going to be key. And we're building with that in mind. But also, there's just a mega trend in general around live content.
Yeah.
And I don't think right now, at least, the high quality dubbing, even with AI and enabled voice, can be done live. But if that content comes out, it probably wants to be in all the global markets within, I don't know, 24 hours. 12 hours before that piece of content maybe is no longer relevant. So I also think there's going to be a big push for really fast turnaround. And we on the captioning side and accessibility side, we're turning around tens of thousands of videos every month within a few hours.
Well, because there's going to have to be. It's like you can talk about the cost, and yes, cost is coming down, obviously, right? But also the turnaround times coming down. And that's equally important, I would say, because the shelf life of most media these days ain't what it used to be. Like, as you mentioned, especially once we start getting into, you know, streaming online and stuff, you know, we're on a 24-hour news cycle now. I'm not going to watch a clip from 3 days ago about, you know, the most recent whatever.
What I would add to that is that there's almost also way more content. The cost of production's gone way down also over the years. So you've got multiplier, many multiples of videos, and it's still the same team that's managing it all. So there's no way you can have individuals in the middle of the process,
right?
Making it all work.
It needs to have a technology solution.
I think it's a good insight on the shelf life, though, that probably doesn't get talked about enough. When we talk about this kind of voice technology paradigm shift, increasing the dubbing market, which is, I think, where people should focus. It's it's creating new use cases. It's opening up. The first thing you think about is price. Someone who couldn't make a dollar, didn't have a positive ROI at $400 a minute, maybe they do it 40, maybe they do it 30, maybe they do it 20. So there's sort of economic transactions that happen that didn't in the past. But I think the fast turnaround is as big of an unlock.
Yes.
There's content that didn't make sense to ever dub at any price if it was going to take 3 weeks to deliver it, because 3 weeks is an eternity in media and that's no longer relevant. Right. If that quality can get hit, but in 8 hours, now that market's interesting.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I'm just saying, because you guys do so many different markets, you know, you're in entertainment, education, technology, e-learning. Each one of these has very different requirements, pain points, unique challenges. I don't want to sideline the conversation. We don't need to turn it into discussion about that. But I mean, let's just take education, for example. So I teach a course at the Middlebury Institute. I think this is going to be my last year next year. On account management, that's localization professionals. It's a graduate level course. I'm just an adjunct, but they have full-time instructors, very good people. And I thank God that I don't teach a class on language technology, because I would have to create a new curriculum every semester, not even every year, every semester. Account management, I can just update it once every few years. It's fine, right? But see, this is my point. Like, even in academia, which traditionally and notoriously moves, I had a professor one time that said, academia moves, but it moves on a triangular wheel. Right. So even for a vertical like academia, things are moving quicker these days. There's a need to move quick.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think for us, this brings it back to the need for it to be a product and not a service is really what it comes down to. And that it needs to be technology first in every which way. Yeah. And especially when it comes to the customer experience. So there are definitely differences between the different systems that each industry might use. So, you know, the corporate space and even media might use Brightcove and YouTube a whole lot, whereas the educational institutions will use Kaltura and Panopto. Yeah. So like all the same concept in terms of publishing and storing video, but different systems. Good news is they're all API enabled, and that's kind of how we solve that problem. And then when you get into the actual content and the actual delivery that we are working on with whatever the customer may be, we think about it in terms of configuration and templatizing the process and having all of the controls and dials built into our system so that we put a little bit of work in up front to get that setting right. Mm. And it all kind of goes and gets repeated over and over again.
Yeah. And the customer has all those controls. So it applies across, you know, all the services we offer. But, you know, you do have this sort of bias towards configuration, which is like set it up once. But then if it ever needs to change, the customer has those controls over API or in the account system. But then the content kind of flows through the system, and the tools are largely the same. You may use the AI different models depending on content type or depending on use case. The tools are largely the same. The people are given different instructions, or maybe use a different subset of your marketplace for a particular task or a particular use case. But largely, it's just different routes through the same, you know, call it assembly line or pipes. And I think that's what unlocks scale. If you want to focus, almost be use case agnostic. And then even, you know, the jobs to be done can vary, you know, within, and it's almost easiest to describe that in dubbing, but, you know, at different price points, at different quality expectations or levels for the customer, you'll do different things. And then you can not just use, you know, AI to let's say do a draft translation or to produce voice. You could also use models to guide people to the jobs that need to be done and highlight the areas of risk or highlight the areas they should focus on. So there's a lot of ways to sort of customize the experience depending on the need.
Yeah.
I think to your point, Tucker, the thing that's changing so much, even in education, is kind of the industry trends that we have to be sensitive to and work with that might dictate who needs a solution and why. Mm. So in the education space, we see things like Title II coming, you know, in early next year and needing to basically make a lot more content accessible. In the media space, this trend of, you know, much more live on the streaming platforms, YouTube creators thinking about localization, like all these different things that will dictate a use case in a conversation that we need to be educated to have and ready for from a product perspective as well, because there definitely are changes. That I think is probably the biggest challenge that we deal with.
Yeah.
It's just the reality that we're introducing ourselves to many more trends.
Yeah, and the question I always like to ask when I talk to folks or companies like yours is, so people, you can localize YouTube videos using your solution, right? Well, why would I use your solution when Google has its own automatic generated subtitles, right? And I say this kind of facetiously because I'm a language guy, but hey, I'm a 17-year-old YouTuber. I want to expand into that lucrative Brazil market with my Twitch streams. Why not just check that button that says auto translate to Portuguese?
Yeah. So I guess my position in this, maybe, you know, considering we're in the language space,
we're kind of biased, but it's a valid question that people are going to have. Right?
I'd honestly say, if you think it's, try it. If you think it's good enough, the reason, I mean, the best person to ask that question of is the YouTube creators themselves, and almost universally, particularly the ones with many, many subscribers, have already answered that question, at least with the state of technology today. Hmm. You know, they're saying not good enough, damaging. They've run the experiments. It's better to not have them on than have them on. We're talking about dubs more than subs here. But and yeah, they have the case studies. They're very open about what they've done. Like the really high-end YouTube creators are serious about localization in the same way media companies are. Maybe they don't have the budget, so they're and they don't have the historical context, which anchors them to a voice actor first solution for their audience, right? But they're serious and they don't want brand safety matters. They want it to sound good. They want it to really drive results. And I think they've landed on a hybrid solution to help them do that. And I'll say, just to kind of level set, at least on the dubbing side, like, you know, we hear a lot about AI dubbing and in some, we use that term. I hate this term because it implies it doesn't get at the real work that's being done, which is with a fully, it wasn't even fully human before. There was plenty of technology in a sort of voice actor first solution already. Mm. But in that workflow, you might be talking about hundreds of hours of human time in the traditional workflow, when including casting decisions and all of the acting done and all this. Even in an AI dubbing environment, to hit a really high quality mark, even in YouTube, certainly in media, you're still talking about tens of hours, 30, 40, 50 hours a time. This isn't someone goes and checks two boxes, hit submit, and we're done.
There's a
lot of work still being done.
But going back to our point we made early on about jobs are changing, certainly, right?
Definitely.
A few jobs are going away. Many jobs are changing, right? Yeah. So this is talking about how jobs are changing. So you say there's still going to be tens of hours, right? Hey, it's less than hundreds of hours. But in your experience, what are those tens of hours? What are people, what's the job that people are working on there?
I mean, this is my favorite topic. I mean, I think, let's just take like a concrete example.
Okay.
Like there's a 30-minute video, maybe there's 50 speakers in that video. And maybe them 10 are primary characters, maybe 40 are, you know, have a line or two. And let's say you want to dub that into 10 different languages. I mean, I got to check my math here, but you know, 50 voices into 10 languages. You have 500 casting decisions before you've started.
Dear God.
And just in casting alone, there's lots of different strategies. You've heard the term clone. There's designed voices. There's community voices. Mm. There's many different strategies to cast. That some require customer input, some don't. Some require intervention and even lots of intuition. You can design new voices, create new voices, even if you're picking from a library. We want linguists who are experts. I'd love voice actors who are experts to help us decide which are the right voices and which aren't. And that's before you've started, right? Once you actually start, you still need to produce, so let's say this video is in English, a really rich, high quality English source document. You know, again, bias here because we are an English captioning and transcription company historically, but we put a ton of time and human effort and jobs into producing that, what we call dubbing template or dialogue list is a common term, mm-hmm. but it is a rich document filled with human judgment The words have to be accurate. The speakers have to be clear. The timing has to be perfect. You want to embed metadata like emotion and characteristics, speaker characteristics that help in refining casting. All this stuff in this document, you're going to spend hours and hours making that document terrific because you save time to the right as you fan out. Mm-hmm. When you go into 10 languages and you get that document in front of your linguists, now you've got a really rich place to start. So just casting and creating that sort of source document, you're already at, you know, again, if you're trying to aim for a really high quality, like media kind of ready result, you've probably spent for an hour long file, 10 hours, a while, a long time.
Yeah.
If you're, again, really serious, there's obviously versions of this that are much quicker. You can do it all with AI, but for a really high quality mark. And then you get into the language space. And I actually think this is where the technology is kind of the biggest unlock, because you take something that used to be multi-step and you can kind of do it to get, you can sort of take the adaptation, the translation part and the vocal direction or vocal production. And it can be done by multiple people, but it can be done in one environment. Hmm. And you can in real time change your adaptation and, you know, use LLMs, of course, to help do that efficiently. But you can work through it. You can resynthesize the voice. You can listen to it. And it's kind of magical to be able to do that in a dynamic setting, in a real-time setting. But to get that really right, again, your hours of work in that setting. And then at the end, you need to mix still. You need to produce a really high-quality set of assets at the end. And again, there's automation to do these things. You can also use high-end sound engineering software, and there's hybrid approaches. Yeah. And so along the way at each of these steps, there's a dial. We use this metaphor a lot internally. There is, of course, an AI only, and in some cases it's like, you know, garbage in, garbage out, but there's a dial you can turn and you can decide just how far you want to turn it at each of these steps.
I think an important assumption here that we're talking through is there's pretty high value on this content, right? So if we look at the accessibility work we've been doing forever, it's pretty high value content. That's why there's a regulation associated with it or a compliance piece associated with it. If it was just, say, an interview that a journalist is doing, you know, to write a piece, like there's not a ton of value in terms of the outside world and kind of who's viewing it. So maybe AI is appropriate for that. And you know, to the whole YouTuber example, like maybe if the content is more just like a hobby and they're just playing video games and they're the only ones talking, maybe AI is okay. But when we get into the high value content that people have to get right, where there's a real cost or a real consequence of a bad job, whether it be captions or dubs, it doesn't matter, then you're talking about wanting to make sure it's done right. And AI is just very far from that, is the reality. And so we've already talked with, you know, a number of YouTube creators, and they all kind of say the same thing, which is the viewing experience has to be consistent. We have to keep the viewer in the program, right? Like, it's that idea of keeping the viewer. And as soon as the dub is terrible, you lose the viewer.
Well, because it's a dub, it might be a terrible dub, but even for generated English voice, you know, text-to-speech technology, it's not good for long term. It's great for 15 second TikToks, but your brain gets tired after listening to it for more than 5 minutes. And there's been, you're shaking your head because you've seen the same studies as me, right?
We like to use the phrase, it's like a game of telephone, right? You string enough AI solutions together and like what you actually get on the other end might be what was originally said.
Well, and also it's just like, you can't listen to it. It's like, try listening to a podcast from some amateur podcaster that won't spend $50 on a microphone, right? Okay. You can't do it because the quality is too bad. It's kind of the same thing with AI. It's just something, it's that uncanny valley or something that after a while your brain's just like, no, I can't do this anymore. It's stressing me out.
And Tucker, that's why, you know, I know the focus of today's conversation is AI dubbing, and we can largely keep it there, but that's, you know, on the accessibility side, we mentioned audio description at the beginning. Mm-hmm. Everyone's familiar with closed captions. Not everyone's familiar with audio description because it's mostly just used by blind, low vision users. But it's the analog. It's describing a scene for someone who can't see.
Yeah.
So you close your eyes and imagine it's described. This is something, particularly in the corporate setting, we've been using synthetic voice or AI voice for years.
Right.
And it's well accepted and it's well adopted. And I think one of the primary reasons, besides that it doesn't get as many views as, you know, a dub in German in Germany. But it's also that the end user there, someone who's, again, blind, they're right. they're operating all day through the internet using a screen reader,
right.
which is synthetic voice. So they've grown accustomed to it.
Exactly.
So the reason I just bring that example up is it's a good place to start. So for media companies that maybe aren't as used to using synthetic voice, there's a use case audio description where the end user is already bought into the technology, which is a lower hurdle to start experimenting with this stuff. And we have seen some success there where it's a good place to start, and it's also the right thing to do.
Yeah.
And it's more efficient. But again, to your point, like there's an audience that's more accustomed to it.
Well, and yeah. Sorry, Josh.
Go ahead, Doug.
Well, I was just saying, you mentioned these lower hurdles, right? And right now, when we're talking about AI, we're not just talking about subtitling. We're not talking about dubbing. We're not talking about language. We're talking about everything. Everything's being affected by AI. Every company with over 100 employees has a CEO that's told somebody, I want you to look into this AI. Or I work with some of these companies. They just are told, you need to use AI. Well, what for? I don't care. Use AI, right? Yeah. But at the same time, they have legal teams and InfoSec teams and all of these other teams that are saying they can't use it, right? So the trend that I've noticed, and this wasn't noticed by me first, I'm stealing it from someone else partially, is that people are looking at things like closed captioning, like subtitling, like localization, as kind of a safe entry point. Like, as a company, we want to shift towards an AI-first culture, AI. Let's dip our toe in the water and let's do that with subtitling. Let's do that with localization, right? Before we use it for our code, for example.
You're spot on. And I think we've seen examples. We've absolutely had conversations with people who have said we've been told to use more AI.
Right.
And so the good news is we can actually look them in the eye and say, hey, look, we can be an AI partner for you because guess what? We use AI. Already, like you don't have to, switch us out or find someone else to do this. But I think what really matters here is understanding what does that even mean, right? Like what does use AI mean in the grand scheme of things? And what are you trying to accomplish? If it's about efficiency or cost reduction, great, let's have that conversation. And I think what we're seeing, and at several events in the media space, this has come up where everyone's testing something. And it could be around the content. It could be around processes. I think to your point, Tucker, content is a safer place because it doesn't disrupt necessarily day-to-day strategy or outcomes, my revenue, like in a direct way. It might indirectly.
And it's not their core competency.
Right, yeah. Right. Especially in the enterprise where video is supporting the business. Video is not the business.
It's not the core business. It's a support function.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I think it's funny, like it comes in waves, right? Like, I think 2 years ago, 3 years ago, there was this big moment, ChatGPT, OpenAI. I think there was a lot of first order thinking of just like use AI or we'll be behind. And like use AI or, we won't have the shareholder value that we want to have because we need to be seen as an AI company. But if you complete the sentence now, and I think we're far enough along that we can do this, it's use AI, like Josh said, to do something. So to reduce costs, to reduce turnaround, to be able to invest in another area of the business. And then I think the final part of that sentence is do so safely. Do so without damaging our business.
Responsibly, yeah.
Responsibly.
And ethically, right?
And ethically and responsibly, safely, morally, these things.
All of these things,
And I think saying those things out loud is helpful. And with our customers who are experimenting with this kind of AI first posture, let's say in a safe place, more on the English captioning side, maybe where the content is the audio is really clear and maybe the models perform well, Josh alluded to it at the beginning, but we're selling even to them these AI solutions with predictive analytics. So it's like you get this AI, but part of experimenting is knowing, being able to kind of sleep at night, knowing when it fails and knowing that you have something to do when it does. So it's, here's a score, here's a confidence score, here's some predictive analytics, here's a report card attached to it. And then you decide what you want to do. And you can go back to your CEO who's barking about AI and say, we ran it, we used AI for all of it. And for 60% of it, it was good. But this 40%, I still need budget because here's what we got to do. And it helps them make those decisions in a more informed way.
Yeah. It gives you ammunition to have with your boss.
Exactly. Right.
So much of what we do in this life is ammunition to use with your boss.
Yeah, I mean, so many of the successful implementations of AI that at least I've heard about are more about helping someone be more efficient. And that means there's a person involved in actually executing the task.
So, yeah.
And so it's just a matter of how can you use it as a tool in a way that adds value?
Yeah. Let's go to someone left a comment question here. Valerie Petit says, interesting conversation. I am from France, lived in USA for years. When I go back to France and watch US movies that are dubbed, it sounds terrible just because the voices do not match the real actors' voices. So whether they are AI voices or real voice actors, there is a loss in experience. I would say, makes sense. I've heard that before, but I would say that's an abnormal situation because if you grew up in France, you would think that dub was the actor's voice, and then Arnold Schwarzenegger would sound weird when you heard his real voice.
I think that's a great point. I think one of the most exciting pieces of this whole AI dubbing or whatever we want to call it, this dubbing with new technology game is that there's an opportunity to experience the content in a voice that mimics the source. And to me, that's I can't speak for everyone, but personally, I think that's a better experience. Now, yes, there are absolutely challenges with getting the AI voice to be really, really good and making sure that that experience is excellent. But when you come down to the nuts and bolts of what voice am I experiencing, I would rather have one that sounds like the source as opposed to a new actor.
Yeah. And I think this is a really interesting question. There's obviously a lot of ways you could go, but start with, it doesn't get any better than the dubbing in French. In France, it's an art. And for the, on the higher end of the spectrum with traditional methods, it's pretty exceptional what they're able to accomplish. But I do think, like Josh said, one of the things that is very hard to accomplish in a casting setting in a traditional voice actor model is finding the person who sounds just like that person, if that's the goal. And it's not always the goal. Sometimes it's not at all the goal. You want to have a different actor and a different, for some reason. But if it is, it is certainly simpler to do it in a voice technology context.
And I think it's worth noting, this whole effort is not a shot at people who are doing dubbing in traditional ways or voice actors. They do excellent work.
Right.
And there's certain content that absolutely should continue being done that way. And I think we need to make sure, I think that a lot of the conversations over the last year with this technology have gotten muddled in terms of what's the actual objective here? And are we taking aim at people or not? That's not the point.
No, we're not taking an aim. And thanks for caveating, because we do need to, I kind of take that for granted because I assume people know me. But if someone tuning in for the first time might just think I'm bashing human voiceover actors. I'm not. No, that's not what I'm doing, right? So thank you for that caveat, right? There's still a very active role to be played for people. Well, it's absolutely crucial.
Well, and Tucker, I think it's crucial in the existing way it's done, but you mentioned different jobs, which is, I think, such an important part of the conversation. There's another approach that I think is really interesting for the higher end AI-enabled or AI voice-enabled dubbing. Product and solution, and it's called speech-to-speech. So basically, there are cases where someone's singing, or there's so much emotion, or for a number of reasons, you cannot get a model tuned from text to sound like you want it to sound.
Okay.
So there are ways you can actually have an actor act, perform, speak, and then repaint their voice so it sounds like the character. Even across gender, across within language, but across gender, across age, across different demographics. This is pretty cool. It's like a voice actor with a superpower. You can have one voice actor, and you need an actor because we've all tried to perform and do this stuff, but an actor can come in and use these tools. They can now play the part of 50 characters, right? They can speak and you can repaint their voice. That's a really powerful way for a voice actor to plug in to this new trend and provide a ton of value.
Right.
So that's i.e.
be able to charge more for their services.
Yeah.
Right. You're so doing that's what's in it for
the
them.
All of the actors.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's yeah. So thanks. That's a good note to wrap up on, is that there are exciting things are happening with technology out there, but there's still so much need for people. Right. And I feel for those people because they're feeling very left out right now, because all anyone wants to talk about is technology. And I get it. We're excited about technology. Technology is doing amazing things, right? But it's also important to acknowledge the people that are doing the work, because without them, there's no one to run the technology. So, well, I'm just keeping my eye on the clock here, gentlemen. Any closing thoughts for well, first of all, how can people find out more? Because we didn't get a demo from you today. But it's a cool product. I've gotten a demo. How can people reach out for more information if they want to see a demo, if they want to find out more, if this is for them? Who should reach out to you? How do they reach out to you? When, where, how? All of that stuff.
Yeah, so easiest is probably go to our website, 3playmedia.com. We will be releasing some demo content with all the things we just talked about very soon. Mm-hmm. So definitely keep an eye out for that. I think that'll be really cool. But yeah, we're not that hard to find. Yeah. So happy to have conversations, and this is, you know, especially like this is, we love geeking out on this stuff.
Yeah. We're open books. I mean, reach out to me or Josh directly on LinkedIn too. I mean, we love these conversations, and we want to, like, this is a really exciting time and everyone, vendors, customers, are in a discovery phase. So conversations like this are, we cherish all of them.
Awesome. Yeah. So make sure, go follow these guys on LinkedIn. Go check out 3playmedia on their website. Gentlemen, it's been a pleasure to geek out with you about all of these new advancements. I really appreciate your time today. I'm going to take us out here.
Thanks, Tucker.
Thanks, Tucker.
All right, ladies, gentlemen, chat. We are out of time for today. If you enjoyed this Nimsy Live experience, then join us next time. Oh my God, do we have one tomorrow? I don't know. But join us next time. We're going to do more. This is episode number 140-something. We're going to keep going. Go over to our LinkedIn page. Go to the events tab, and you can see all of the events coming up, upcoming live streams. I appreciate our guests today, Chris and Josh. I appreciate my colleagues here at MZ Insights doing all the hard work so I can have these fun conversations. And I appreciate you, the audience, joining us live, joining us in the conversation, or watching the recording. And I look forward to next time. Cheers.